Welcome to It's More Than That.
I got bullied a reasonable amount. I was small and bookish and also racially other. The context that I was in had a high tolerance for me being bullied and a relatively low tolerance for my fighting back.
It's More Than That is a podcast by the University of Minnesota Duluth. I'm Paula Peterson. Often we don't understand the full story of someone's reality. Join me as we explore the complexities of the human experience. This week on the show, Janine Weeks-Schroer. Well, welcome to our Campus Climate Podcast. We have with us today Dr. Janine Weeks-Schroer, who is Associate Professor and Program Chair of the Department of Philosophy here at UMD. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So, do you mind if I call you Janine?
Please do call me Janine.
Okay. All right.
Because I'm going to call you Paula. Otherwise, it will be very awkward for me.
Perfect. Perfect. That works. So Janine and I have done some work together on campus in the community, and I am just excited to have our audience hear more about you and the work that you do and what you're passionate about. And so thanks. So we like to start all of our interviews with this notion of just kind of who you are and what brought you to UMD, where you're rooted, where you come from, your journey a bit.
Okay. So my journey is slightly convoluted bringing me to Minnesota, but there is a significant sense in which Duluth is very much home. I grew up in Ohio, in central Ohio, Buckeye country, for those of you who care about sports.
Which team are all of the teams Buckeyes?
It's the Ohio State, State University.
Okay, gotcha.
I grew up in the suburbs of Columbus, Ohio. My family moved there when I was eight, halfway through third grade, because of education stuff. Which is, I think, not an insignificant part of how I got to be thinking about the kinds of things that I think about. Mm-hmm. But maybe I'll come back to that.
Yeah.
So we moved from Columbus to the suburbs of Columbus, Reynoldsburg, Ohio, 99% white town at the time. I went to the rest of my primary school, middle school, junior high, and high school through Reynoldsburg. And my mother didn't want me to go to the Ohio State University because the population of the university was larger than the town I grew up in. So I went to Miami University in Oxford, Ohio, about 15 to 20 minutes away from where the Klan started.
The Ku Klux Klan.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's the Klan I was
talking
about.
That's the Klan.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's right. Unfortunately, right. It's not it's not a good Klan, the Klan. And after getting a bachelor's of philosophy in interdisciplinary studies, I went to University of Illinois Chicago for graduate school in philosophy. That's where I met my partner, who's from Duluth.
Oh, I did not know that.
He also was a graduate student in philosophy at University of Illinois Chicago. Despite advice from my advisor not to marry a philosopher, I did. And when we finished, we moved to Arkansas, Jonesboro, Arkansas, to teach at Arkansas State University, where we taught for 6 years. And then after that, there was an opportunity to come up here. UMD was advertising a job in philosophy science, I believe. And Bob sent an email because he went to UMD. That's my partner, okay. Bob. He got his undergraduate degree here, to one of the professors who was his professor when he was a student here and was still a professor at the time, and said, you know, wouldn't it be funny if you had two jobs, because I have another philosopher that I trail with me everywhere. And they said, as a matter of fact, we are going to be trying to hire someone in the sort of vein of ethics. And that's roughly what I do under some description. So we came here and we've been here for 8 years. And like I said, all of Bob's family is here. I grew up in Ohio, but Ohio wasn't ever really home for me, and has only become less so as I've gotten older. Even though I personally don't have my origin roots here, I feel very rooted here in Duluth.
And how many years have you been here?
8 years Eight that years. We've lived here.
Okay. Yeah. So let's go back to the significance of your family moving when you were eight.
So
just go there.
I had to, I think, classic middle class, working towards middle class, actually, black parents. My dad grew up poor in New York and went into the military, hated it, but benefited from the GI Bill. And my mom moved from Chicago, where she grew up, to Ohio to go to the Ohio State University. Had the experience that a lot of students have at the Ohio State University, which was that she was overwhelmed being on her own for the first time and failed out of Ohio State University after, I believe, one semester. And went to work. They met shortly after that, around 20. They got married when they were 20. So they must have met a little earlier than that. And after a little bit, they had me, and they did the sort of standard things that up-and-coming black folk do. They worked full-time. They got a very inexpensive starter home in a not great, not horrible, working class neighborhood in Columbus. And I lived there until I was eight. The problem was is that because I had two working parents full time, and when I was, in my developmental years between three and six, my parents were both working full time and going to school full time. I spent a lot of resources were spent to have me have care during the day, and some of those resources were educational. So when I went to kindergarten, by the time I went to first grade, I knew how to read, and not just initial, but I was a decent reader, and it was a problem. In Columbus Public Schools, they could not deal with me in the school that was near our house. So when I was in the first grade, for about a month and a half, I just got into trouble all the time because I would do my work before the teacher explained it to us. And she assumed for a while that I was just messing around, but then it became clear that the problem was that I could read, and I just went forward. So then they gave me a bunch of reading tests, and the strategy they decided upon when I was in the first grade was that the best strategy was for me to spend part of my day in the third grade classroom for reading. I was an eager, excited student, and the third graders didn't love that. They did not love a tiny first grader answering all the questions. So by the time I got to second grade, they decided to try something else. And what they decided then was that they were going to put me in a special reading group. But the reading group I was in was with remedial students from fourth, fifth, and sixth grade. So I was seven and in a smaller group of kids, but in a group of kids who really despised me by that point. Then there was busing. When I was in the third grade, I got moved to a statistically more white school. And I did better. I had better opportunities for my for intellectual stimulation. And so I was less of a problem. I was more stimulated. I was more excited. Busing is never popular. So my parents just decided that all in all, a better strategy would just be to go live somewhere else. So that's when we moved to the 99% white schools that I went to from third through 12th grade.
Okay.
And the education for me was better, but everything else about the context was complicated. Mm-hmm. Nobody was like me racially, and it was a problem until high school. So it was a lot of marginalized-based bullying. Mm-hmm. I mean, people who were demonstrably lacking class privilege, people of color, people who did not reflect traditional gender roles, standard stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all in all, I think it was a pretty okay school with regards to those things, but it wasn't perfect by any means.
And what a trade-off your parents and family had to make.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I think that that's what a lot of middle class black folk, especially at that time, think the bargain is. Like, mm-hmm. That's what you have to choose. You have to choose between tolerating communities that are significantly different from you and that will expect assimilation, and or having a lesser product in mm-hmm. terms of the resources that your kids have. I'm not sure how different it is now.
Yeah, right. So expect assimilation. How did you respond to that?
Well, I mean,
young person.
My dad was old school.
Yeah.
I learned very early on that I had to learn to follow the rules and expectations of the context that I was in.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about this the other day because one of the things I've been thinking about and become passionate about lately is about figuring out how to help young people deal with institutional racism and the microaggressions that come with it. And one of the things I have to be really grateful for from my parents, even though it was difficult, is that my dad made sure to instill in me a tool set that would make me function in the context that I would find myself in.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, right, I went from a 99% white high school to about 96% white college. That's my university.
Mm-hmm.
And then I entered into a discipline that is about 98% white to this day. So the skill set that my father put in place paid off,
mm-hmm.
But it was high cost. I learned that it didn't matter if it was fair, it didn't matter if it was right. It only mattered what the rules were. It only mattered that I follow the rules. And sometimes it was unfair. I mean, before that time period when everybody knew me and that sort of adjustment was made, I got bullied a reasonable amount. I was small and bookish and also racially other.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a lot. And the context that I was in had a high tolerance for me being bullied and a relatively low tolerance for my fighting back being mm-hmm. bullied. And I learned that lesson a couple of times. It took me a couple of times to figure it out, to get it really clear in my head. There was sort of mixed bits. So I was in daycare after we moved, and a kid was calling me by a relatively mild racial slur, all things considered, I mm-hmm. guess. And I didn't like it, and I told him to stop, and he didn't. And I told him that if he didn't stop, I was going to tell the teacher, and he didn't. And so I told the teacher, and she told him to stop, and he didn't. And I told the teacher that she needed to make him stop or I was going to make him stop,
mm-hmm.
and he didn't. So I struck him.
Mm-hmm.
I hit him with my flat hand hard enough that it left an imprint on his face for a while, and that was a big deal. It was such a big deal that the sort of director of the daycare center asked that my parents and I come in to have a special meeting.
Hmm.
And the meeting was about me learning to control my temper. And I explained to my parents and I explained to the director that I didn't have a problem controlling my temper.
This was a conscious.
Yep.
And
I never lost my temper.
An informed choice. Yep. Yes.
And I warned everybody about what was going to happen. Yep. I didn't just tell the teacher that I was going to make him stop. I told her that I was going to hit him.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what my 8-year-old self thought I was executing there. I think justice, but it was an important step where I learned that there are some places where they don't care about justice. Mm-hmm. They don't care about certain kinds of brutality, and certain kinds of performances are unacceptable. It's lucky for me, I think, that this was quite a few years ago now. I think if I was in grade school and in the last 10 years, I could have been putting myself on a track. This did not happen in a school. It happened in a daycare center. But if I had struck a student or struck a teacher, which happened the next year at my daycare center under similar circumstances, she hit me first. Mm-hmm. I didn't think it was fair. And I thought about it and I decided to hit her back.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I didn't lose my temper. But I did get in a lot of trouble, especially at home. And the lesson that my dad was trying to teach me is that I don't get to use the kinds of coping mechanisms that my peers who are white would get to use.
Mm-hmm.
The world will not be kind to me. The world will not be fair to me. I have to figure out a different way to navigate those kinds of injustices and to function in that system. So I did. I learned not to hit, and I learned that even when someone was hitting me, I shouldn't hit.
Yeah.
And I've been able to navigate that system in a way that shows a kind of success that people don't anticipate from people like me. That is to say, nobody expects there to be a black female philosopher.
Mm-hmm.
And why should they? There's only like 40 of us. So I would like to figure out a way to develop those skills in a less, I think, a more generous way. My dad had no tolerance. He didn't want to hear my sad story.
Hmm.
He didn't care about somebody chasing me with scissors. He didn't care about someone following me around all day. He didn't care about me being hit first. The rule was that I didn't break the rules, no matter what, no matter how much it cost me, no matter how hard it was.
Yeah.
I don't want to instill that lesson in anybody, but I do want to instill what comes with accepting that lesson, which is figuring out other ways to deal with, figuring out other ways, other places to put the anger, to put the resentment, figuring out different ways of getting petty revenge, because I think sometimes you need that. I think you need to feel like the universe is just. And I think that that's a hard skill for young folks of color to develop in our current context, because I don't think that their institutions have resources to help them develop those skills. And I think that a lot of middle class parents of color are like my parents.
Yeah.
And they want to teach it the hard way, where it's just a zero tolerance policy and you just have to learn to put up with it.
And so what do you, I mean, what do you do that with that as a young person? Like, where did you put it?
I was super depressed and anxious and grew up to be a fairly depressed and anxious person. I mean, I feel like at this point in my life, I have a significant amount of control over that part of myself. But there was long periods when I was suicidal. There were, even when I was succeeding, a persistent sense that I didn't belong anywhere and that any wrong step was going to throw me off the path. I was not a very happy young person. Mm-hmm. I was hanging in because I thought it would make my mother sad if I didn't. Mm. When I was 15, I did not think I would live to be 30. Mm. I was surprised when I did. Yeah, and that's not the best place. Yeah. I think that there's a lot of things that I could have done better and would have done better if I hadn't had to spend so much energy managing anxiety and depression.
Mm-hmm. So when and where did that shift for you? I mean, the person you're describing is not the person I've experienced, which certainly doesn't mean that's not, you know, not there, but...
Well, I think a lot of things, I think there's an expression, I don't remember where it comes from. It happened very slowly and then all at once. I worked on it.
Yeah.
When I was in my 20s and was still so sad sometimes that I thought I should just fall off the planet, I found people to help. I tried to get people to help. And I've had better and worse therapy, but I've had a very good therapist that I've had a relationship with on and off for more than 20 years. Mm. I don't have regular therapy now, but I do sometimes call her when things get hard.
Yeah.
So that was the first piece was... I just wanted to work better, to not be so anxious all the time, to not be so self-loathing. Mm-hmm. And it made a huge difference. I mean, I think it's complicated. I don't know what anxiety and depression are like or what the kind of sort of self-loathing and anxiety are like for other people. But I very much had this kind of dual personality. Mm-hmm. There was a person who, you know, I knew I was smart. I wanted to go to graduate school since I was 7.
Wow.
And I thought I was funny. I still think I'm funny. And I had lots of friends. But there was just this other dark place that I was carrying around all the time. And so the person I am now, I think, is a person I've been for a very long time. She's just carrying a little bit less weight or has a better backpack to carry it in, maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I had therapy, I had help, and I started to think about sort of, you know, what some of the sources were. And I know that some of the sources do have to do with race and gender oppression, for lack of, you know, mm-hmm. less dramatic language.
Yeah.
But some of it is, you know, normal. Well, I don't know. Some of it is the stuff that's hard for everybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, difficult relationships with your family. I think my dad worked very hard to make me tough. And I think that made my relationship with him difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was part of it. And so, but if I weren't tough the way I am, the way he made me, I wouldn't have been able to do a lot of the things I did.
Yeah. And it sounds like you might not be here.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. You mentioned earlier your passion about how to help young people with institutional racism and hearing your story. It makes so much sense about you wanting to help them to maybe have a similar outcome, but through a different process,
yeah.
If that's fair to say.
Yeah.
And it's just interesting for me to hear Janine in this notion of, you know, working on systemic and structural. Clearly, we want to, like, change institutional racism. And also needing to help while and until that happens, being there for those young people.
Yes.
And how to navigate and deal with that. So what, do you have some ideas or inroads with that you can talk about?
inroads about helping young people.
Yeah, like so what your plan is.
Doing a lot of stuff.
Yeah, okay.
And I don't... it's very interesting. I'm afraid of young people. When I decided and thought about being a teacher, it was always going to be college students mm-hmm. and never going to be, you know, younger people because they're terrifying. And so now I'm trying to put myself in a position where I'm going to be engaging more with those exact people. Mm-hmm. And I've been doing a number of things. It started accidentally. Mm-hmm. I got put in touch by a friend of mine with a student, a woman of color student at a local school. And I started talking to her via email about her experiences and mostly just about the stuff that I'm interested in my research, which is thinking about race and racism and agency and oppression and gender, et cetera. But she was having a hard time. And what she was having a hard time with had to do with institutional structures. And I talked to her for a while, and I had to stop because of personal stuff that went on. And then I had another encounter with another high school student at a different high school about similar issues. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've always recognized about Duluth is that it's a town very much like the town I grew up in, the suburban town I grew up in. It's not quite suburban, but it is. It's very similar. People talk about Minnesota nice and this kind of pulled in reservedness that is bordering on unfriendly. It's not just Minnesota. Mm-hmm. Right. There's people all over the Midwest who, you know, don't engage mm-hmm. and they're not mean, but they're not going to go out of their way to engage you. And it's also the case that in my experience as a person living and growing up in a place like that and living in a place like this, and as a teacher who thinks about race and racism, it's very hard for people to appreciate how different the world looks to you when, let me put that a different and more direct way. It's very hard for white people to appreciate how different the world looks to you when mm-hmm. you're not white. And I want to be clear, this is a general cognitive problem. We all are what I would call epistemically located. We all are reading and understanding the world from a specific location that provides us with specific details. So that in the same way that I don't know what's on the wall behind my head, I don't understand necessarily or don't see as clearly or don't see all of the things that people who are socially located different from me do. Mm-hmm. But the difficulty with issues like race and gender and ethnicity and ability and sexual identity is that our normalizing of our perspective is ridiculously high cost for mm-hmm. people who are outside those statistical norms or outside that perspectival norm that I've developed. So what I've been thinking about is trying to figure out a way to, A, give these young folks more people to talk to about their experiences, more resources for managing the stress it causes, but also figuring out ways to get them more leverage in the institutional structures where they find themselves so that there's some pressure that can be put on people to try harder to figure out ways to work around the epistemic blinders that they have on and the reinforcement of those complications by the institutional structures that they find themselves in. So I've been talking to educational specialists in Duluth. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go talk to a committee on inclusion and diversity at a particular school in Duluth today. Yeah. And I have been talking with other folks who do activist work around racism and young people in Duluth. And so far, I'm at the beginning. And for me, that's a little bit interesting and terrifying. I don't consider myself an outgoing person. I consider myself an introvert. So going around talking to lots of different people about a hot topic, that is to say a politically inflammatory topic, is not necessarily what I conceptualize as my wheelhouse.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been fun. I've been enjoying it. And I feel like it might be going somewhere.
It was one, if you don't mind me asking, one of those interactions at the TED.
Yes.
At the TEDx talk.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. So for context for listeners, Janine and I were on a panel with Jordan Moses at the Teatro.
Yes. TED at Teatro.
TED at Teatro talk on race.
Yep.
And I remember that moment because a young person asked a question about how to respond
yep.
to the racism and microaggressions that she was experiencing. And what I was so touched by your response was it became clear at that moment that it was between you and her. You stood up, you walked toward her, and you talked specifically to her in this way that the rest of us got to observe perhaps what it looks like to really hear a question that, like, it was a question for the panel, but it was more than a question. It was an ask for help.
Yeah.
And to watch you respond in a way that was direct and specific, and here's my email, and we will talk. It was really powerful.
I really appreciated her asking that question. I think she was asking a really hard question, and it was really brave of her to do that mm-hmm. in a public context. But one of the things that I thought was really important to be clear about, one of the things that became clear to me when I was trying to figure out what to tell her, because the question that she asked was something like, how do I respond politely? How do I inquire politely with my teachers, etc., when I feel like these issues are being trampled upon, when I feel like these mm-hmm. issues are being trespassed upon? And the thing that I became clear to me as I was trying to formulate my answer is there's not an easy way for her to address that problem. One of the things that we strategized about when we developed our panel
mm-hmm.
was about thinking clearly about anti-racism as an address to a structural problem. There continue to be efforts in especially complex institutions, but also discursively in talking about race and racism, to try to make everything individual and personal, to try to make it, you know, what can I do to do about this?
Mm-hmm.
And the issue is that she's not in a position where she has anything like the kind of power that could make this any better.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that she shouldn't resist. It's that it's a fantasy, the narrative that if you ask the question in the right tone of voice, if you ask it with the right kind of placation, that the person will not become offended, the person will not become defensive, that you won't encounter someone's white privilege, that you won't encounter someone's other kind of institutional or cultural or social privilege, and that everything will just go smoothly, that you'll then figure out the mm-hmm. way. You'll be able to figure out the way of contact that doesn't explode on you. And I really needed her to know that. I really needed her to understand that the difficulty that she was encountering the difficulty that she was considering is not about her tone of voice about which words to use. And to be fair and clear, what I think is important to realize is that it's not entirely up to the other party how they respond either. I'm not interested in being in the business of demonizing the fact that particular individuals respond badly to these questions. Because that makes perfect sense given the social context that they're in.
Mm-hmm.
That makes perfect sense from the epistemic position that they occupy. That's why it has to be a structural address, because what we have to do is fix the machinery around them so that they can see more of the picture more clearly,
mm-hmm.
and so that the fact that we don't all see the picture clearly at any given time is controlled by the structure so that people don't get hurt.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think what I reflected on so much after, and we haven't talked about this, is, you know, her question was to the panel. And so, of course, I'm sitting there thinking, should I respond? And if I do, what might I say? And my wheels are turning around things she could do. You might try this. You might try this. And you so clearly shifted that responsibility right away. You don't have the power. You're the student. You, in a way that I had to look at, okay, is like, is that my whiteness showing up in that space? And grateful that you spoke up before I did. But that had an impact on me as well as just what, I mean, basically what you're saying. I was going to respond at that individual level. Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that's wrong. Yeah. Those are some of the tools that I want to help these folks have.
Yeah.
Those are the tools that my father gave me, these individual tools, these tools that are about self-control and managing your emotions and figuring out ways to table things for another outlet and figuring out ways to see the very best. Here's my superpower. I think this is true. It's very easy for me to see good in people who are doing terrible things. To see how the terrible things that they're doing reflect ordinary human urges, and that below these terrible things that they're doing are decent and good intentions and values and plans and projects. I want to be clear about that. I don't mean that there aren't evil people. I just mean that a lot of evil that people do is done in the name of good, mm-hmm. because people are trying to do good, because people are trying to make the world safer or smarter or kinder or more virtuous. It doesn't let anybody off the hook,
mm-hmm.
that we have good intentions. But it does make it easier, I think, inside your body as a human being to let go of the anxiety about evildoers and to let go of the anger and resentment about evildoers. Now, that's my way, and I don't think that's the only way.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think that it helps, because I think that there are a lot of microaggressions that you can let roll off your back when you realize that that person really is trying to give you a compliment, or that person is really trying to give you advice. Like, I think the advice that you were offered is valuable advice, I suspect. I suspect that figuring out better ways to talk about these things is a really important tool that I want to give these students.
Mm-hmm.
It just can't be the only strategy that we use. Yeah. And the hardship is that we have to accept that it doesn't always work. That mm-hmm. even when you have the very best narrative, even you have a very good relationship. What I was thinking about when I was talking to her is my mentor when I was an undergraduate in college. He passed away about 4 years ago. He was a really smart, great, privileged, upper-middle-class Jewish guy. And in my time knowing him, there were so many things that happened that really turned my head in complicated ways. But as I got older, as I became a professional, he was also a philosopher. We had a fight. We had a really nasty fight. It wasn't nasty in the sense that it was, you know, sort of, you know, performatively vicious at the time. It just stopped us talking to each other for like a year. I had become a philosopher of race by that point, and he asked me about an incident he had when he had gone into a Walgreens or something like that and had been picking up photographs and thinking about other things, and had been standing in front of a woman of color cashier, a black woman, and she told him how much he owed, and he placed the money on the counter because he was lost in his own thoughts and head. But she had been holding her hand out to take the money from him. So she was standing there with her hand extended, and he just placed the money on the counter. And apparently she went off. Apparently this was her, you know, this was the final microaggression that she could handle for the day. And she unpacked it for him and talked about, you know, his profound failure of humanity. And we had a disagreement, he and I, because he told me the story and he said, it's not that she was wrong. I respect what she said. I just didn't like the way she said it. And I said, no, sir, that is not correct. There's not a way that she could have said it. There's not a particular set of language. There's not a calmer voice that she could have used. There's not a reference that she could have pointed to that would have made you less annoyed. She read your white privilege. It made you anxious and embarrassed and defensive. And that's what you're carrying around. And if she had done it in a quiet voice where she nicely leaned over and said, hey, I know you don't have to because you're a white man in America, but how about you treat me like a human being? Instead of, you know, whatever sort of performative, you know, yelling or whatever it was that he felt that she did instead. He did not like hearing that from me. And I understood. I understand. You know, I was his protege and a younger person. And he identifies as a, he identified as a progressive, politically right-minded person. And I think he's right about that. But he's also a dude who is, you know, living on one very, on the very high wall of white privilege, standing right next to him. And one of the things that's hard for us, one of the really difficult hurdles we have to get over is that we have to come to terms with that. We have to come to terms with the fact that there are places where we will have significant failures of perception and will do evil because we do. And it, to be precise and absolutely clear, you know, I don't, for the most part, have white privilege, but I do have other kinds of privilege, like ability and class and sexuality. And in some of those arenas, there's been a fair amount of progress that facilitates the ability to do better. But in some of those arenas, there haven't. And just like everybody else, I stumble over my own feet. I jam my own feet in my mouth. I make mistakes in those arenas where my perspective is not as clear. And that's just going to have to be part of it. That's just got to be part of our human journey. We have to come to terms with accepting it.
Well, hearing your story, I can, about your, that mentor or advisor, I can think of all the times that, that I've been in that position as a white person, and all the stuff that can go through my head that are rational excuses about why it wasn't that. You know, why it was just that I was, you know, I was distracted. I wasn't thinking that way. and needing to really go through a strong cognitive process of the privilege even in that.
Well, I mean, I think it's difficult because one of our important American Western narratives is about intentionality and agency, about our ability to execute our actions based on our reasons and our will.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the hard clarifications that contemporary discourse about racism and sexism and all the other isms brings to bear is that we do not have, even when we are excellent agents and we have very well constructed agency and we have tremendous amounts of privilege, we do not have perfect control over what our agency affects in the world. And we don't have the right to not take responsibility just because it wasn't what I meant to do, especially given the fact that the consequences of all the things that we don't mean to do pile up and end up being so severe for some people.
Mm-hmm. Any thoughts, insights, perspectives on UMD and our climate? And
I mean, I think one of the things that it's hard for us to, I don't know if we don't like it or if we just forget that it's true, that we can put institutional structures in place that manage our behavior, that manage the character or the consequences or the outcome of our behavior. I was thinking about bullying. I remember having a talk with you quite a while ago about the fact that one of the outcomes of the climate surveys had to do with bullying. And I was interested because I have spent some time thinking about whatever bullying is and how it gets used in institutional contexts. And I believe that at that time is when I found out that one of the significant concerns is that a lot of the staff feel bullied. And I just started thinking about what professors are like and what they've historically been like. At my previous institution, not this one, I had a professor who a coworker at that point, to be clear, every semester would go into the department secretary's office and get her to print off his rosters on the pretense that he didn't know how to do it. He's a PhD in something. And it's not to say that people don't have different kinds of domains of ability, but it is to say that a smart person, a person with the kind of drive that it takes to get a doctoral degree, could figure out how to print out their rosters if they were willing to give themselves the energy and resources to do so. But he didn't, because he didn't have to.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not so much, that's not so much an instance of bullying, but it strikes me that it's an instance of the kind of behavior that can surround bullying, that professors in general, and probably especially people who have historically been more likely to be professors in the United States, are inclined to expect lots of privileges with that. Lots of extras that didn't have, that we didn't have before. People to do your photocopying, people to, at my graduate institution, there was a chair that we had for a time who didn't send emails. He would write them out and give them to his secretary to send. He would handwrite out things and give them to his secretary to send. That's ridiculous. All due respect to that person. That's absurd. That is making twice as much work out of a project that doesn't require that much work. But historically, he has the privilege and entitlement to do that. But I think that because our culture and our society is improving with regards to things like class privilege. And to some degree, gender privilege. It's just no longer the case that the people who typically occupy those positions, the people who typically occupy staff positions, understand themselves to have these kinds of responsibilities. And it's not only that, because the probably real game changer is institutional pressures that make it the case that those folks have just a lot more work on their plate. Mm-hmm. They just don't have time to do your photocopying. They don't have time to type out your emails. But I think that there's a lot of professors who don't understand that. Mm-hmm. Their mind has not shifted with the culture and the institution. And so then they show up with expectations. And because our institution, for example, doesn't do things like, and by institution, I mean UMD, nobody ever sat down with me and talked to me about what it actually is the duty of my staff person to do. Mm-hmm. And I think it just varies from person to person. And some people are kind and some people are less kind. And that's not reasonable. Mm-hmm. That is not a reasonable demand. That is not a kind demand to put on our staff for them to figure out what duties they find acceptable and to be the gatekeeper right. with regards to people who in many instances conceptualize themselves as their superiors, even though they're not, because we all work together for UMD, mm-hmm. not for each other.
There's a lot of staff who will love to hear you say that, because I think that's not the attitude in many units.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and that's wrong. I mean, that's wrong.
Even the term support staff is interpreted as supporting faculty, supporting your role as program chair, supporting
students. So we should all be support.
Supporting.
Right. I'm a support associate professor then.
Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. That's powerful.
We're all doing the same.
Yeah.
We all work together doing different roles. And I mean, and it's easy to figure out how you know that, because there are things that I learned this lesson the easy way, relatively speaking, when I first went into graduate school. My graduate program was a program with a relatively late start, mid-September, mm-hmm. which meant that we didn't get paid until early October. So, you know, you show up at Chicago in August, and you don't have that much money, but you need 6 weeks worth of money mm-hmm. to get to when you're going to get a paycheck, which is not going to be that much money at that time. And even now is only, you know, it's a borderline living wage. I didn't get paid. My first paycheck didn't come. And I was like, I can't pay my rent. Mm-hmm. I don't have food. I can't pay my bills. And I went to the department secretary. I did what you were supposed to do, which is I sort of, you know, went through various kinds of institutional structures and it just didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And so I finally went to my department secretary, desperate, and was like, I'm sorry, I don't know what to do. I'm sorry to bother you, but I need money, and they didn't give me any. She gave me a slip of paper, and she told me to go to an office, and I took that slip of paper to an office, and they handed me my paycheck.
Wow.
I don't know what was on that slip of paper. But that was not the first time that I realized that that person had magical powers.
Mm-hmm.
That was not the last time that I was aware that that person had magical powers, that my department secretary had magical powers, that there were things that she could make happen that I could not make happen, that I didn't understand or know anything about. And so it was very easy for me to carry that lesson forward that, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, you know, fantastic resource I bring to the table, there are really valuable ones that this person brings to the table.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, in a practical sense, often more valuable. I could not get myself paid. She could get me paid that day.
So that's a survival valuable.
Right.
Yeah.
And so I do think that we need to understand that. And I do think that, you know, And it's difficult because you spend all this time getting this degree and you have this picture in your head of what it meant because of what it was like when we were college students. Mm-hmm. But what it was like when we were college students was wrong. Hmm. And we have to put it down.
Yeah.
And we have to be responsible and kind. But when we as individuals aren't responsible and kind, the institution has to do it for us. The institution has to say, these are the things that your department administrator can do for you. These are reasonable latitudes by which you can ask this person to do for you. These are extra things that your department administrator might be willing to do for you, but you should ask them if they're willing to do this and not assume that they are. And maybe not even that. Maybe you don't get to ask them. Like, would it be okay if you... Nope. Don't ask. Mm-hmm. Because you don't appreciate the kind of pressure that creates for that person. Because it's not just that they want to be liked. It's not just that they want to have a sort of functional working relationship with you. But they understand that you and the letters after your name may have more institutional clout than they do. And so then they may feel like they have to do it because mm-hmm. you want them to. And that is the kind of thing that we want to think about and characterize as bullying, even though it may not be harsh. And I mean, don't get me wrong. Sometimes I have the clear impression that sometimes some of us are harsh in ways that are evidently inexcusable with our staff and our expectations and our sort of disappointment of mm-hmm. those expectations. But even just sort of gentle pressures where you're like, can you do this thing for me that I probably should do for myself? So I've been thinking a lot about that because I was surprised that people felt bullied until I spent some time trying to figure out what would make people say that? What kinds of things would make that happen? And how probably commonplace it is. But yes, I do think that we have to get over our sort of class nonsense with regards to who works for who and who's important and who's not.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that came up for me is I had the opportunity and privilege to be faculty in our Study in England program years back. Common practice was everybody was staff. There wasn't this faculty, staff, and students, and administrators, like all these different, everyone who was employed at the institution was staff. And there was an equalizing nature to it
that respectful.
Would be really powerful to institute.
Yeah.
You know, we're all employees, we're all staff, and as you said, we have different roles. And how might just even that language shift impact some of what you're talking about?
And it is important because I think any faculty member who spent any time, so I've only been program chair for about just one semester. Mm-hmm. And so part of your task, probably the central task that you have as a program chair, is problem solving for students. Figuring out how they can get credit for transfer, figuring out how they can get credit for study abroad, figuring out whether they can graduate this semester, figuring out what kinds of hurdles have to be jumped through to make sure that all of their ducks are in a row for that kind of thing. And again, it's a quickly humbling experience to realize how much you don't know about the function of the institution, how much you don't know about who does what, when, mm-hmm. how they do it, and what difference it makes. And so then you find yourself relying a lot on these folks that are called staff. Not less valuable. Mm-hmm. I mean, the unfortunate truth is, I'm a professor of philosophy. My central skill set that I bring to the table is my ability to, you know, teach about this certain area of expertise I have. And I feel really fancy about my expertise and spent many time developing it. But the truth of the matter is that they could slot just any number of people out in the world. There are just a whole bunch of extra experts on what I'm an expert on, sitting around in the world trying to get jobs. that they could slot into my slot today and it would be relatively seamless. There's people who are working in advising offices. If those people leave, that place falls apart until not just they get a replacement, but until that person has had 5 or 6 months on the job and figured stuff out.
Well, that's a good point. Yep.
I'm just not the most important piece of this machinery. Not me individually, no matter how sort of hard it was for me to get my piece and how proud I am for the piece I got. I'm sorry. I don't know why I am. I don't mean to go on about the sort of staff bullying. It's just that it strikes me as it's one of the areas where, when I was talking earlier about blind spots that we have because of our privilege, it's one of the areas where I felt like I had a blind spot. And so I started thinking about it really hard.
Yeah.
And so now I have lots and lots of opinions about it.
Well, it's powerful, too, because you're talking about, I mean, earlier you talked about the places where you are marginalized and were bullied. And now you're talking about the places where you are in the position of power and privilege.
Yeah.
And I think that's, if we could all do more of that, the both and, I think there's a lot to that. So you might have already answered this question in your mind, but there might be more. I like to ask all of everyone who sits in that chair, our campus climate campaign it's more than that. And part of this podcast grew out of that want for these kinds of in-depth conversations that allow. And it's more than that, beyond the tweet, beyond the Facebook, beyond the poster and their message is really allowing us to muck around in the complexity that these topics are. So I love the theme a lot for that. And just like to hear what's your it's more than that.
I think that for me, the it's more than that is about our being complex and vulnerable humans together. I think I'm one of those people who probably wants everyone to like me. It's not so much that I assume that's true, but I think that I want it to be true. And I like people, so I like having positive and satisfying connections with people. And so I always try to find people that make me feel good about being with them and find out who those people are and interact with them and, figure out ways to interact with them more and to... And that's one of the things that sort of doing this work has been great for, is meeting more people about whom I think, oh, this is a good person, this is an interesting person. I want to do more of that. When that's your approach, when your approach with people is greedy mind reading, there's a English professor, I think her last name is Sun, who talks about our desire to sort of know what goes on in people's heads and find out what, what's going on in there and think about that. I have a bad case of that. I desperately am interested in sort of how people's minds come together and what they think about and what they care about. And I get great satisfaction from having those kinds of interactions with people and all the people. Then it's easier for me in a certain way to not trip over my class privilege, because what I think about this person is, oh, I like this person, I don't want to annoy them. Oh, I like this person, I don't want to hurt their feelings. Whether they're a secretary or an advising specialist or a colleague. And it's difficult sometimes because I don't do as good a job because it's not as obvious how to be vulnerable when you feel like you've trespassed. I'm good at saying I'm sorry, but I also recognize that sometimes when things get difficult or complicated, it's not so much because someone did something wrong. And then it's awkward and confusing to say you're sorry. I'm not so good in those complicated situations. People who are more professional, I suppose, is a way to put it. Less leading with emotionality and connection and relationality. Don't run afoul of that the way I do, because they don't have the sense or anxiety about trespass that I do. So there's different ways to do things, and they each have their virtues. But my way, and the virtues of my way, is that sometimes it is easier for me to not trespass, because I'm always engaging with everybody as much as I can, as if they're my best friend, as if they're a person who I like and care about, independently of how our connection serves my interests or serves my job's interests. And that can make me unfair and lazy, I think, in certain ways, about how it can be hard for other people. Because one of the things that I have that makes that easy is, when I was very young and I took Myers-Briggs tests, I scored very high, like moderately high on the introvert scale. And as I've gotten older and older, less and less high score on the introvert scale. And sometimes I even score as an extrovert, which still surprises me. But for people who still score as an introvert, that way, leading with that relationality foot is harder.
Yeah.
And so then it is harder. It is easier to sort of stumble over things and not recognize trespass. And some of those trespasses are interpersonal and are individual. But sometimes, like in my life history, they're also tied up with institutional trespass. And the institution needs to sort of set itself up to help all of us. I think our institutions, UMD is not alone in this, but UMD is included in this, can be lazy. And really, they make the same mistake that the rest of us make in thinking that if we just teach people to follow the golden rule and be decent agents, that that will do most of the work. It would be better if the institutions facilitated some of the work, facilitated structures that made it the case that, you know, if I'm not so, if I don't have so high an EQ, so high an emotional intelligence, that I don't accidentally bully my staff person, or that I don't accidentally presume that my colleagues will not bully my staff person if I don't give them clear indications about what the staff person can and can't do for them.
So if we create clear policies and procedures to cover when people and individuals don't do it.
I think our institutions make a mistake that I often make with my students. You want to respect people, and so you think that explaining and articulating and providing guidelines can be insulting. You think, well, they're adults, they can read the syllabus. I shouldn't explain this to them. That's insulting. That's diminishing. Maybe, but what's worse is when people feel adrift about what your expectations are because you didn't articulate it, or because you assumed that it was articulated well enough on paper and didn't give them an opportunity to ask you specifically. And so for me, it's more than that, is thinking about what it is you bring to the table and how that is a resource and how it fails to be a resource at addressing things like bullying, but also things like racism and sexism and genderism and religious hostilities and ableism and all the other things. I just think that it's more than that really is helpful, because I think that our fundamental failure as ethical agents right now is in having come to believe that it will be easy to be good. I think it might be easy, or at least accessible, to not be evil for most people most of the time, to not in your person be evil. But it's not easy to do good. It takes work. And it takes different kinds of work depending on who you are, and that's okay. But you don't get to sort of shrug it off because it's easy for person A, and since it's not easy for you, maybe you don't have to do it.
Yeah, or that's somebody else's work. Thank you.
Is there
anything else that you will wish you wanted to say that's part of this podcast?
I don't know. I feel bad because I'm just enjoying talking to you, and I keep thinking, I'm just blathering on.
No, that's what we do. That's what we do. Because it's more than that.
It is. Yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
And it's more than even just the words.
Yeah.
Guess I would just say that, you know, I'm really enjoying having this talk with you. And in the past, I've enjoyed having talks with you. So that's not a surprise. But I do like to talk about these things. I do find it interesting to talk about these things. And I do take this to be a sort of significant project that's ongoing. And so I thank you for giving me the opportunity to have a thoughtful conversation with you about it. And I encourage anybody to come by my office, 305 A.B. Anderson, if they want to have more conversations. I won't always be available, but I will always be interested.
Yeah, that's fabulous. And maybe more campus conversations, too.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, maybe that's...
Absolutely.
That's where this will go. And I'm grateful to you and the work that you do, not only in your classroom, but being able to extend it to others now is really... I'm excited to do more together.
Me too.
Yeah.
Me too.
And have some fun, too.
Yes.
We need to tour each other's chicken coops.
Right. Bob just cleaned ours.
Oh, mine's not clean yet.
Now's a good time.
Sarah cleans ours, and she's heading out of town, so probably won't be anytime soon.
We should also have a discussion about, you know, the privilege of not being the chicken coop cleaners.
Yeah, that's
There's
true.
Something.
There's something in that. And so, because I know you have chickens, a gift that I give to our guests as a thank you, just a small token, but it feels big when it's your own eggs, is I give eggs to people.
Right.
But I know you have your own eggs and your own chickens. So
that's right.
I brought you something else from our little farmstead, which I know you appreciate, is some of this year's maple syrup.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah. Here's a really funny thing.
Yeah.
We don't tap our trees every year, but we did this year.
Yeah.
We don't tap our trees. I don't know how many maple trees you have. We just live on, like, you know, 3 acres. And so we have, like, I don't know, maybe 6 or 10 trees. And only, like, 4 of them are really old. So we only tap, like, 3 or 4 of them. So we only get, like, a very tiny amount of syrup. But I'm glad to have yours.
So you know what goes into that.
Right, because do you also have bees? Right. Yeah. So apparently, I'm just you know trying as hard as I can to be your doppelganger. So that should be a little creepy and anxious for you, because we have chickens. We tapped a few trees this year, and we got about 4 of these.
Okay.
And we got our bees. Our bees did not survive the winter.
Yeah, okay.
So we got our new bees like last Friday, like a week ago Friday.
Okay.
So far, so good.
Okay, good.
But we don't, last year we didn't collect any honey. Mm-hmm. I don't anticipate us collecting honey in the future.
Yeah.
Because we're two people. Can we do 25 pounds of honey?
Well, and it takes so much for them to winter over.
That's right, exactly.
Yeah.
The bees need it.
But really, it's the second year I've found where you get any honey.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't get any last year either. But
okay.
Fingers crossed, one hive survived.
Right.
So
good.
If we get honey.
Yeah. So we'll have to, you know, you'll have to give us tips about your, we have some sense about things we might have done wrong last year with the bees. But that's very impressive, surviving this, especially this past winter.
Yeah, yeah. I don't take any credit for it. And I mean, it seriously is that it feels like there's so many variables and elements that I just feel lucky.
Yeah.
So when one survives, but all right.
But thank you so much.
Yeah.
For the syrup.
Thank you.
That's fantastic.
For being here and
thank you for having
the conversation. And there will be a sweet little jingle that ends this.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. You can listen to more episodes of UMD's It's More Than That podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. Visit d.umn.edu/campusclimate to find additional information on our episodes and more about what the University of Minnesota Duluth is doing to build a better, more welcoming campus community for all. And you can sign our pledge and work with us on your own personal journey.